Welcome to Dublin City Libraries. Hello, and welcome to Storytime at Kevin Street Library. We have two stories for you today, one quite long one, and one a little bit shorter. Ciarán is going to read us a fairy story now, an old Irish story, about two children who go off in search of fairies and magic. It's called The Golden Spears. Once upon a time, there lived in a little house under a hill, a little woman and her two children whose names were Connla and Nora. Right in the front door of the little house lay a pleasant meadow, and beyond the meadow rose up to the skies a mountain whose top was sharp pointed like a spear. More than halfway up it was clad with heather, and when the heather was in bloom it looked like a purple robe falling from the shoulders of the mountain down to its feet. Above the heather it was bare and grey, but when the sun was sinking in the sea, its last rays rested on the bare mountain top and made it gleam like a spear of gold. And so the children always called it the Golden Spear. In summer days the children gambolled in the meadow, plucking the sweet wild grasses, and often they clambered up the mountainside, knee-deep in the heather, searching for freckins and wild honey, and sometimes they found a bird's nest. But they only peeped into it. They never touched the eggs or allowed their breath to fall upon them. For next to their little mother, they loved the mountain. And next to the mountain, they loved the wild birds who made the spring and summer air musical with their songs. Sometimes, the soft white mist would steal through the glen. And when it crept up to the mountain, the mist would cover it all with a veil so dense that the children could not see it. And then they would say to each other, "Our mountain is gone away from us." But when the mist would lift and float off into the skies, the children would clap their hands and say, "Oh, there's our mountain back again." In the long nights of winter, they babbled of the spring and summertime to come, when the birds would once more sing for them. And never a day passed that they didn't fling crumbs outside their door and on the borders of the wood that stretched away towards the glen. When the spring came, they awoke with the first light of the morning, and they knew the very moment when the lark would begin to sing, when the thrush and the blackbird would pour out their liquid notes, and when the robin would make the soft green tender leaves dance with its song. It chanced one day that when they were resting in the noontide heat, under the perfumed shade of a hawthorn in bloom, they saw on the edge of the meadow, spread out before them, a speckled thrush cowering in the grass.
"Oh, Connla, Connla, look at the thrush, and look up in the sky. There's a hawk," cried Nora.
Connla looked up, and he saw the hawk with quivering wings, and he knew that in a second it would pounce down on the frightened thrush. He jumped to his feet, fixed a stone in his sling, and before the whir of the stone shooting through the air was silent, the stricken hawk tumbled headlong into the grass. The thrush, shaking its wings, rose joyously into the air, and perching upon an elm tree in sight of the children, he sang a song so sweet that they left the hawthorn shade and walked along together until the last they stood under the branches of the elm and they listened to the thrush's song. At last Nora said,
"Oh, Connla, did you ever hear a song so sweet as this?"
"No," said Connla,
"and I do believe a sweeter music was never heard before."
"Ah," said the thrush, "that's because you never heard the nine little pipers playing. And now, Connla and Nora, you saved my life today."
"It was Nora saved it," said Connla, "for she pointed you out to me, and also pointed out the hawk which was about to pounce on you."
"It was Connla saved you," said Nora,
"for he slew the hawk with his sling."
"I owe my life to both of you," said the thrush. "You like my song, and you say you have never heard anything so sweet, but wait till you hear the nine little pipers playing."
"And when shall we hear them?" said the children.
"Well," said the thrush, Sit outside your door tomorrow evening, and wait and watch until the shadows have crept up the heather. And then, when the mountaintop is gleaming like a golden spear, look at the line where the shadow on the heather meets the sunshine, and you shall see what you shall see." Having said this, the thrush sang another sweet song, sweeter than the first, and flew away into the woods. The children went home, and all night long dreamt of the thrush and the nine little pipers, and when the birds sang in the morning, they got up and went into the meadow to watch the mountain. The sun was shining in a cloudless sky, and no shadows lay on the mountain, and all day long they watched and waited, until at last, when the birds were singing their farewell song to the evening star, the shadows marched from the glen, trooped up the mountainside, and dimmed the purple of the heather. When the mountaintop gleamed like a golden spear, they fixed their eyes on the line between the shadow and the sunshine. "Now," said Conall, "the time has come."
"Look, look," said Nora,
and as she spoke, just above the line of shadow, a door that was never there before opened out, and through its portals came a little piper dressed in green and gold. He stepped down, followed by another, and another, until there were nine in all, and then the door shut again. Down through the heather marched the pipers in single file, and all the time they played a music so sweet that the birds, who had gone to sleep in their nests, came out upon the branches to listen to them. The pipers crossed the meadow, and they went on and on until they disappeared in the leafy woods. While they were passing, the children were spellbound and couldn't speak. But when the music had died away in the woods, they said, "The thrush was right. That is the sweetest music that was ever heard in all the world." And when the children went to bed that night, the fairy music came to them in their dreams. When the morning broke, and they looked upon their mountain and could see no trace of the door above the heather, they asked each other whether they had really seen the little pipers or only dreamt of them. That day they went out into the woods, and they sat beside a stream that pattered along beneath the trees. As the children watched the water sparkling where the sunlight fell, Nora said,
"Oh, Conall, did you ever see anything so bright and clear and glancing as that?"
"No," said Conall, "I never did." "That's because you never saw the crystal hall of the fairy of the mountains," said a voice above the heads of the children. And when they looked up, who should they see perched on the branch but the thrush?
"And where is the crystal hall of the fairy?" said Conall.
"Oh, it is where it always was, and where it always will be," said the thrush. "And you can see it, if you like."
"We would like to see it," said the children.
"Well then, if you would, all you have to do is follow the nine little pipers when they come down through the heather and cross the meadow tomorrow evening." And with that, the thrush flew away. Conall and Nora went home, and that night they fell asleep talking of the thrush and of the fairy pipers and the crystal hall. All the next day they counted the minutes, until they saw the shadows thronging from the glen and scaling the mountainside, and at last they saw the door springing open and the nine little pipers marching down. They waited until the pipers had crossed the meadow and were about to enter the wood, and then they followed them, the pipers marching on before them and playing all the time. It was not long until they had passed through the wood, and then what should the children see rising up before them but another mountain, smaller than their own, but like their own, clad more than halfway up with purple heather, and whose top was bare and sharp-pointed, and gleaming like a golden spear. Up through the heather climbed the pipers. Up through the heather the children clambered after them. And the moment the pipers passed the heather, a door opened, and inside they marched. The children followed, and the door closed behind them all. Conall and Nora were so dazed by the light that hit their eyes when they had crossed the threshold that they had to shade them with their hands. But after a moment or two, they became able to bear the splendour, and when they looked around, they saw that they were in a noble hall, whose crystal roof was supported by two rows of crystal pillars rising from a crystal floor, and the walls were of crystal, and along the walls were crystal couches with coverings and cushions of sapphire silk with silver tassels. Over the crystal floor the little pipers marched. Over the crystal floor the little children followed,
and when a door at the end of the hall was opened to let the pipers pass, a crowd of colours came rushing in, and the floor and the ceiling and the stately pillars and the glancing couches and the shining walls were splashed and dashed with a thousand dazzling hues. Out through the door the pipers marched. Out through the door the children followed. And when they crossed the threshold, they were treading on clouds of amber, of purple, and of gold.
"Oh, Connla," said Nora, "we have walked into the sunset."
And around and about them everywhere were soft, fleecy clouds, and over their heads was the glowing sky, and the stars were shining through it. The sky and the stars seemed so near that Connla thought he could almost reach out and touch them with his hand. When they had gone some distance, the pipers disappeared, and when Connla and Nora came up to the spot where they had last seen them, they found themselves at the head of a ladder, all the steps of which were formed of purple and amber clouds that descended to what appeared to be a vast, shining plain streaked with violet and gold. In the spaces between the streaks of gold and violet, they saw soft, milk-white stars, and the children thought that the great plain so far below them must also belong to the magic cloudland. They could not see the little pipers, but up the ladder, carried by the cool, sweet air, was the fairy music, and lured on by it step by step, they travelled down the fleecy ladder. When they were little more than halfway down, there came, mingled with the music, a sound almost as sweet, the sound of waters toying with pebbles on a beach. And with the sound came the odorous brine of the ocean. And then the children knew that what they thought was a plain in the realms of the cloudland was, in fact, the sleeping sea, unstirred by wind or tide, dreaming of the purple clouds and stars of the sunset sky above it. When Connla and Nora reached the strand, they saw the nine little pipers marching out towards the sea, and they wondered where they were going to. And they could hardly believe their eyes when they saw them stepping out upon the level ocean as if they were walking upon the land, and away the nine little pipers marched, treading the golden glow laid upon the waters by the setting sun. And as the music became fainter and fainter, as the pipers passed into the glowing distance, the children began to wonder what was to become of themselves. Just at that very moment, they saw coming towards them from the sinking sun a little white horse with flowing mane and tail and golden hoofs, and on that horse's back was a little man dressed in shining green silk. When the horse galloped to the strand, the little man doffed his hat and said to the children, "Would you like to follow the nine little pipers?" The children said, "Yes."
"Well then, come up here behind me, you first, Nora, and Connla after."
Connla helped Nora up, and then climbed on the little steed himself, and as soon as they were properly seated, the little man said, "Swish!" And away went the steed, galloping over the sea without wetting hair or hoof, but fast as he galloped, the nine little pipers were always ahead of him, although they seemed to be going only at a walking pace. When at last he came up rather close to the hindmost of them, the nine little pipers disappeared. But the children heard the music flowing beneath the waters. The white steed pulled up suddenly and wouldn't move a step further.
"Now," said the little man to the children, "clasp me tight, Nora, and Connla, cling on to Nora, and both of you shut your eyes."
The children did as they were bidden, and the little man cried, "Swish! Swash!" And the steed went down, down through the still sleeping ocean until at last his feet struck the bottom.
"Now open your eyes," said the little man.
And when the children did, they saw beneath the horse's feet a golden beach, and above their heads the sea like a transparent cloud between them and the sky. They once more heard the fairy music, and marching on the sand before them were the nine little pipers.
"You must get off now," said the little man. "I can go no farther with you."
The children scrambled down, and the little man cried, "Swish!" And himself and the steed shot up through the sea, and they saw him no more. Then, Nora first and then Connla, they set out after the nine little pipers, and it wasn't long until they saw rising from the golden ground a mass of dark grey rocks. And as they were gazing at them, they saw the rocks opening, and the nine little pipers disappearing through them. The children hurried on, and when they came up close to the rocks, they saw sitting on a flat and polished stone a mermaid combing her golden hair and singing a strange, sweet song that brought tears to their eyes, and by the mermaid's side was a little sleek brown otter. When the mermaid saw them, she flung her golden tresses back over her snow-white shoulders, and she beckoned the children to her. Her large eyes were full of sadness, but there was a look so tender upon her face that the children moved towards her without any fear. "Come to me, little one," she said to Nora. "Come and kiss me." And in a second her arms were around the child. The mermaid kissed her again and again as the tears rushed to her eyes. She said, "Oh, Nora, Avornin, your breath is as sweet as the wild rose that blooms in the green fields of Erin, and happy are you, my children, who have come so lately from that pleasant land. Oh, Connla, Connla, I get the scent of the dew of the Irish grasses and of the purple heather from your feet, and you both can soon return to Erin, but I shall not see it for another 300 years. I am Livon, the mermaid, daughter of a line of kings. But I may not keep you here. The fairy queen is waiting for you in her snow-white palace. And now kiss me once more, Nora, and kiss me, Connla. May luck and joy go with you, and all gentleness be upon you both." Then the children said goodbye to the mermaid, and the rocks opened for them, and they passed through, and soon found themselves in a meadow starred with flowers, and through the meadow sped a sunlit stream. They followed the stream until it led to a garden of roses, and beyond the garden, standing on a gentle hill, was a palace white as snow. Before the palace was a crowd of fairy maidens pelting each other with rose leaves. But when they saw the children, they finished playing and came trooping towards them. "A queen is waiting for you," they said, and then they led the children to the palace door. The children entered, and after passing through a long corridor, they found themselves in a crystal hall so like the one they had seen in the Mountain of the Golden Spear that they thought it was the same. But on all the crystal couches, fairies, dressed in silken robes of many colours, were sitting, and at the end of the hall, on a crystal throne, was seated the fairy queen, looking lovelier than the evening star. The queen descended from her throne to meet the children, and taking them by the hands, she led them up the shining steps. Then, sitting down, she made them sit beside her, Connla on her right hand and Nora on her left. She ordered the 9 little pipers to come before her and said to them, "So far you have done your duty faithfully. Now play one more sweet air, and your task is done." And the little pipers played, and from the couches at the first sound of music, all the fairies rose and, forming partners, danced over the crystal floor as lightly as leaves dancing in the wind. Listening to the fairy music and watching the wavy motion of the dancing fairies, the children fell asleep. When they awoke next morning and rose from their silken beds, they were no longer children. Nora was a graceful and stately maiden, and Connla a handsome and gallant youth. They looked at each other for a moment in surprise, and then Connla said, "Oh, Nora, how tall and beautiful you are." "Oh, not so tall and handsome as you are, Connla," said Nora as she flung her long arms around his neck. Then they drew back to get a better look of each other, and who should step between them but the fairy queen. "Oh, Nora, Nora, I am not as high as your knee, and as for you, Connla, you look as straight and tall as one of the round towers of Erin." "And how did we grow so tall in one night?" said Connla. "One night indeed. Why, you have been fast asleep, the two of you, for the last 7 years."
"But where was our little mother all that time?" said Connla and Nora together.
"Oh, the little mother was all right. She knew where you were, but she is expecting you today, and so you must go off to see her. Although I would like to keep you, if I had my way, all to myself here in the fairy land under the sea. Before you go, here is a necklace for you, Nora. It is formed out of the drops of the ocean spray, sparkling in the sunshine. They were caught by my fairy nymph, for you, as they skimmed the sunlit billows under the shape of seabirds, and no queen or princess in the world can match their lustre, even with the diamonds dug from the caves of earth. As for you, Connla, a helmet of shining gold fit for a king of Erin. And a king of Erin you will be yet, and here's a spear that will pierce any shield. And here's a shield that no spear can pierce, and no sword can cleave as long as you fasten your warrior cloak with this brooch of gold."
And as she spoke, she flung round Connla's shoulders a flowing mantle of yellow silk and pinned it at his neck with a red gold brooch.
"And now, my children, you must go away from me. You, Nora, will be a warrior's queen and heiress of the streams, and you, Connla, will be a king yet over the loveliest province in all the land of Erin. But you will have to fight for your crowns, and days of battle are before you. When the time comes when you will be called to battle, enter not upon it without the golden brooch I have given you fastened to your cloak, for if you do, harm will come to you. Now kiss me, children. Your little mother is waiting for you at the foot of the golden spear. But do not forget to say goodbye to Lavon the mermaid. She is exiled from the land she loves, and pining in sadness beneath the sea."
Connla and Nora kissed the fairy queen, and Connla, wearing his golden helmet and silken cloak, and carrying his shield and spear, led Nora with him. They passed from the palace through the garden of roses, through the flowery meadow, through the dark grey rocks, until they reached the golden strand, and there, sitting and singing the strange sweet song, was Lavon the mermaid.
"So you are going up to Erin," she said, "up through the covering waters. When you're in Erin of the streams, sometimes think of the mermaid, exiled beneath the sea."
And the children kissed the mermaid with sad hearts, bid her goodbye, and they walked along the golden strand. When they had gone what seemed to them a long way, they began to feel weary, and just then they saw coming towards them a little man in a red jacket, leading a coal black steed. When they met the little man, he said,
"Connla, put Nora up on this steed."
Connla did as he was told, and when both of them were mounted,
"Now, Connla," said the little man, "catch the bridle in your hands, and you, Nora, clasp Connla round the waist, and close your eyes."
They did as they were bidden, and then the little man said,
"Swash! Swish!"
And the steed shot up from the strand like a lark from the grass, and pierced the covering sea, and went bounding on over the level waters. And when his hoofs struck the hard ground, Connla and Nora opened their eyes, and they saw that they were galloping towards a shady wood. On went the steed, and soon he was galloping beneath the branches that almost touched Connla's head. And on they went until they passed through the wood, and then they saw rising above them the golden spear.
"Oh, Connla," said Nora, "we are home at last."
"Yes," Connla said,
"but where is our little house under the hill?"
And no little house was there, but in its stead was standing a lime-white mansion.
"What can this mean?"
But before Connla could reply, the steed had galloped up to the door of the mansion, and, in the twinkling of an eye, Connla and Nora were standing on the ground outside the door, and the steed had vanished. Before they could recover from their surprise, their little mother came rushing out at them, and flung her arms around their necks and kissed them both again and again.
"Oh, children, children, you are welcome home to me, for though I knew it was all for the best, my heart was lonely without you."
And Connla and Nora caught up their little mother in their arms, and they carried her into the hall and set her down on the floor.
"Oh, Nora," said the little mother, "you are a head above me. And as for you, Connla, you look almost as tall as one of the round towers of Erin."
"That's what the fairy queen said, mother," said Nora.
"Blessings on the fairy queen. Turn around, Connla, till I look at you."
Connla turned around, and the little mother said,
"Oh, Connla, with your golden helmet and your spear and your glancing shield and your silken cloak, you look like a king. But take them off, my boy, beautiful as they are. Your little mother would like to see you, her own brave boy, without any fairy finery."
And Connla laid aside his spear and shield and took off his golden helmet and his silken cloak. Then he caught the little mother and kissed her and lifted her up until she was as high as his head, and said he,
"Don't you know, little mother? I'd rather have you both than all the world."
And that night, when they were sitting down by the fire together, you may be sure in that whole world, no people were half as happy as Nora, Connla, and their little mother.
That was a very strange story, wasn't it? Full of magic and fairies and mermaids. I'm glad they both got back to their mother, though. Sylvie's going to read us a story now. It's a bit of a scary story. And apparently it's a bit of a true story, too, about a young army captain living in Ireland who goes to a stranger's house and has something very odd happen to him in the middle of the night. It's called The Radiant Boy.
Captain Stewart, when he was a young man, happened to be quartered in Ireland. He was fond of sport, and one day the pursuit of game carried him so far that he lost his way. The weather had become very rough, and in this strait he presented himself at the door of a gentleman's house, and sending in his card, requested shelter for the night. The hospitality of the Irish country gentry is proverbial. The master of the house received him warmly. He feared he could not make him so comfortable as he could have wished, being full of visitors already. But such accommodation as he could give, he was heartily welcome to. Whereupon, he called his butler and, committing the guest to his good offices, told him he must put him up somewhere. Captain Stewart found the house cramped, and a very jolly party it was. His host invited him to stay, and promised him a good shooting if he would prolong his visit a few days. Captain Stewart thought himself extremely fortunate to have fallen into such pleasant quarters. At length, after an agreeable evening, they all retired to bed, and the butler conducted him to a large room, almost divested of furniture, but with a blazing turf fire in the grate. Nevertheless, to the tired limbs of Captain Stewart, it looked very inviting. But before he lay down, he thought it advisable to take off some of the fire, which was blazing up the chimney in what he thought was an alarming manner. Having done this, he stretched himself on his couch and soon fell asleep. He believed he had slept about a couple of hours when he awoke suddenly and was startled by such a vivid light in the room that he thought it on fire. Turning to look at the grate, he saw the fire was out. He sat up in bed, trying to discover what it was, when he perceived the form of a beautiful naked boy, surrounded by a dazzling radiance. The boy looked at him earnestly, and then the vision faded, and all was dark. Captain Stewart, so far from supposing what he had seen to be of a spiritual nature, had no doubt that the host or the visitors had been trying to frighten him. Accordingly, he felt indignant at the liberty, and on the following morning, when he appeared at breakfast, he took care to evince his displeasure by the reserve of his demeanour, and by announcing his intention to depart immediately. The host was incredulous, reminding him of his promise to stay and shoot. Captain Stewart coldly excused himself, and the gentleman, seeing something was wrong, took him aside and pressed for an explanation. Captain Stewart, without entering into particulars, said he had been made the victim of some sort of practical joking that he thought was quite unwarrantable with a stranger. The gentleman considered this not impossible amongst a parcel of thoughtless young men, and appealed to them to make an apology. But one and all, on honour, denied the impeachment. A thought seemed to strike him. He clapped his hand to his forehead and rang the bell.
"Hamilton," said he to the butler, "where did Captain Stewart sleep last night?"
"Well, sir, you know, every place was full. The gentlemen were laying on the floor, three or four in a room, so I gave him the boy's room. But I lit a blazing fire to keep him from coming out."
"You are very wrong. You know I have positively forbidden you to put anyone there, and have taken the furniture out of the room to ensure it is not being occupied."
The host, retiring with Captain Stewart, he informed him very gravely of the nature of the phenomena he had seen. He confessed that there existed a tradition in the family. Whoever the radiant boy appeared to will rise to the summit of power, and when he has reached the climax, will die a violent death. And he added that the records that have been kept of his appearance go to confirm this persuasion.
Ooh, that was a spooky story, wasn't it? That's all the stories we have this time. I hope you have a lovely day. Why not drop into us in Kevin Street Library when you get a chance? Bye for now. Storytime at Kevin Street Library is presented by Dublin City Library. Storytime at Kevin Street Library is produced by Kieran Hurley. The storytellers are the staff of Kevin Street Library. Music and sound effects is provided by Zapsplat.com and Mixkit.co. All stories are public domain.